This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Tanzina Vega. And we start, where else, with the extraordinary fallout from two nearly simultaneous courtroom announcements that happened 200 miles away from each other.
Michael Cohen pled guilty to 8 felony charges.
Mr. Manafort is disappointed of not getting acquittals all the way through.
These are very serious charges and reflect a pattern of lies and dishonesty over an extended period of time.
As he pleaded guilty to tax evasion and bank fraud, President Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, dropped a bombshell. He said Donald Trump directed him to arrange payments to two women in order to keep them quiet about their alleged affairs with Trump. And this is the big part, for the explicit purpose of influencing the 2016 election. Just minutes later, a jury in Virginia found Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign chairman, guilty on 8 counts of financial crimes. We're going to talk about both of these stories and what they mean with our in-house experts, Andrea Bernstein, senior editor for WNYC, and Ilya Meretz, reporter for WNYC, their co-hosts of the Trump Inc. podcast. Thank you both for being here.
Great. Good to be here.
So great to be with you, Matt.
Okay, Ilya, we're going to get to you in a few minutes to talk about Manafort, but Andrea, let's start with you. You were in the Manhattan courtroom yesterday when Cohen read his guilty plea. Paint the scene for us as it unfolded.
So in the federal courthouse in Manhattan, you can't bring your phones in and you have to get there early so you can make sure you can get a seat. So we're sort of in this bubble. We don't know what's going on in the world. And we don't know what Cohen is going to say. And we walk into the courtroom. The courtroom fills up with journalists. Then there's four prosecutors that walk in and they sit at the table. And then Michael Cohen comes in from a side door by himself and sits down at the defense table, starts looking around, nodding at some of the reporters in the room. And then this proceeding starts. And, you know, guilty pleas are sort of rote. You know what's going to happen. The judge makes sure you're competent. But we did not know, for one thing, what he was going to plead guilty to. And when he got to the campaign finance charges, and he stood up and he said that he had done this in coordination and at the direction of a candidate for federal office. And then the judge sort of stopped him and he said, did you know that this was wrong and illegal? And Cohen sort of sighed and then he said, yes, Your Honor. That was a moment of high drama because not only was he saying that he had committed a crime, but he was saying that he did it at the direction of somebody who he didn't say explicitly in the courtroom, but who we know to be the president of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
Unbelievable. I mean, and that is the takeaway. The takeaway from all this is Cohen's admission that as a candidate, Trump directed him to arrange hush money to two women ahead of the election. And here is Michael Cohen's attorney, Lanny Davis, on CNN yesterday.
There is no factual dispute. Mr. Trump's lawyers said he directed Michael Cohen to make that payment. He is as much guilty of a felony. He just hasn't owned up to it.
So that's really the big question. If Cohen and his lawyer are telling the truth, and Cohen was obviously under oath, is Lanny Davis right? Did President Trump violate any laws?
Well, Rudy Giuliani said, you may recall, despite the fact that Donald Trump had said, oh, no, I don't know anything about this on Air Force One, Rudy Giuliani said some time ago, oh, yes, we paid him $35,000 a month retainer, as is commonly done, to keep information quiet. And what the prosecution said is that is a crime because you're not allowed to make. So Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to both the sort of National Enquirer life rights purchase, which was inducing a corporate contribution, and then another count of making a personal contribution, which was the Stormy Daniels one. And you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to contribute $130,000 for the purpose of influencing an election. That is a clear, bright line violation of campaign finance law. So for Rudy Giuliani to have said, well, yes, we paid him to do that, it does seem to be a crime. Now, of course, President Trump has not been charged.
Sure.
But the fact that there is now this sworn testimony and sworn admission and documents filed in the U.S. In the Southern District of New York is really a stunning development. And I'll add, I think it's really important to say that this is not a prosecution by Bob Mueller. This is a prosecution that took place under Jeffrey Berman, who was appointed by Trump, who was personally interviewed by Trump, which made a lot of Democratic senators upset. He then was recused from this, and his deputy, who he also appointed, took over the case, Robert Khuzami. So this is not a Bob Mueller witch hunt kind of a thing. This is a separate group of prosecutors.
Well, and if these prosecutors in the Southern District of New York believe that Trump committed a crime, as this guilty plea indicates, what does that mean then for the presidency? I mean, can he be indicted? Will he now have to be impeached? I mean, what is the bottom line at this moment from what we know about the state of the presidency?
I think it's very, very unclear what it means legally. I think it's clear what it means in the sort of in the world, which is that this is somebody. I mean, there were very few people who were as dedicated and as close to President Trump as his personal attorney, Michael Cohen. He worked for him for 10 years in the Trump Organization. He did deals around the world, former Soviet Union. And he had said he would take a bullet for Trump. As we know, he shouted down reporters privately and publicly. I mean, he was sort of the bag man for Trump. And for this kind of a person to say, I committed a crime at the direction of a candidate for federal office is a stunning turn of events, not only for his own case, but also for the entire set of investigations into the Trump campaign. Because here we have this moment where suddenly Michael Cohen is saying this campaign was involved in a crime, which is something that we have not gotten to in the other Mueller investigations. So that, I think, is the sort of real turn of the screw in this. We don't know what is going to happen next. For I think at this moment, yesterday afternoon, there was this moment where the rule of law was like, no, you cannot commit these crimes with impunity.
Another variable here is the possibility of a presidential pardon for Michael Cohen. And on NPR's Morning Edition earlier today, Lanny Davis, Michael Cohen's attorney, waved off that idea.
I know that Mr. Cohen would never accept a pardon from a man that he considers to be both corrupt and a dangerous person in the Oval Office. And he has flatly authorized me to say under no circumstances would he accept a pardon for Mr. Trump, who uses the pardon power in a way that no president in American history has ever used a pardon to relieve people of guilt who committed crimes, who are political cronies of his.
The president's lawyer's lawyer calling the president corrupt and a dangerous person in the Oval Office. What do you make of that from Lanny Davis, Andrea?
Well, I think that, you know, we've seen the people that Trump has pardoned, like former Illinois Governor Blagojevich. I mean, Trump has not only sent a signal that it's people that are close to me, he's sent a signal that I don't believe political corruption can be prosecuted. And the fact that prosecutors are continuing to say we're going to do this is of interest. I also think, you know, I like to read the fine print. And in the fine print of the plea agreement, it says that if Michael Cohen, if this conviction is somehow vacated, he could still potentially be prosecuted. So a pardon wouldn't necessarily absolve him of all. The sense I got in the courtroom yesterday was that Michael Cohen had had his moment where he decided, I'm going to accept this. And there was a lot of sighing. There was a lot of saying, yes, Your Honor. But there was an implication, sort of, I have come to this moment in my life where there's all of these other assorted crimes, bank fraud, manipulations with taxi medallions. There's even a crime that was committed where he didn't report to the IRS a broker's fee he had collected for selling a Birkin bag. So all of these assorted crimes, Michael Cohen seemed to be saying, okay, I'm now putting a stop. I'm saying what I did, right, and I want to put a box around this.
Okay, now let's turn to Paul Manafort. Thank you, Andrea. Ilya Marritz, you've been covering the Paul Manafort side of the news. What does the Manafort conviction yesterday mean for the Mueller investigation?
Let me just pause again
how
remarkable this is that two of the people who did more than almost anybody else to put Trump in the White House became convicted felons in one afternoon within
minutes
of each other. And that's just happenstance. But this is remarkable. Manafort was charged with 18 counts of bank fraud and tax fraud. He was convicted on only 8 of those counts. The jury deadlocked on 10 of them. But that's a little bit of an optical illusion, because when you really look at what Manafort was convicted of, it's a broad array of crimes committed over many, many years. And really, it falls into two categories. There was concealing income from the IRS when he was making tens of millions of dollars working for a Ukrainian strongman, a pro-Russian politician in Ukraine over several years. And then later, when Manafort wasn't doing so well financially, he lied to banks to obtain loans, large loans, many millions of dollars, falsified documents, submitted false documents to those banks, lied about the other debts that he had, all of that in an effort to shore up his finances as he was working for the Trump campaign for free in the summer of 2016. So even though it was sort of a split decision, the headline is guilty, very guilty.
Right. And then there's another trial that he has upcoming in Washington. And what is that about, and how does that fit into the Mueller investigation and the presidency?
In just a matter of weeks, that trial is going to begin in Washington, D.C. So this case got split in sort of a strange way. This was the preference of the Manafort defense team to have two trials, but the second trial is in many ways the more substantial one, because that trial examines money laundering and conspiracy. One of Manafort's co-defendants in that trial is his former right-hand man in Kiev, a man named Konstantin Kalimnik, who is considered likely to be a Russian spy. Kalimnik was very involved, as we saw in the first trial, in setting up offshore companies and accounts for Paul Manafort to help him conceal his Ukrainian income. So it'll be really interesting to see what additional information surfaces about that hidden income and about Konstantin Kalimnik's role in all of it. Paul Manafort was working for a lot of businessmen and oligarchs, not just Viktor Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine. There's a lot more information that we could learn in this second trial.
Okay, we're going to let you guys go back to reporting all of this, but bottom line here, if the Congress and the Senate remain in Republican hands, either both the House and the Senate or one of each, what does this end up meaning for Trump himself as president of the United States, Ilya?
He will be a very tarnished president no matter what. But we hear again and again from legal experts that impeachment is the remedy for some of the crimes that Trump may have committed. So that would probably depend on Democrats taking part of Congress.
Andrew?
Trump was identified as individual one in the charge in the Michael Cohen plea agreement, who happened to be president of the United States. He'll have to live with that no matter what happens politically.
Thank you both so much, Ilya Marritz and Andrew Bernstein, co-hosts of the Trump Inc. podcast here at WNYC. We appreciate your reporting.
Great to be with you, Matt.
You're very welcome.
Clean, beautiful West Virginia call. We love it. Right.
That's the president in Charleston, West Virginia, Tuesday night.
And you know, that's indestructible stuff. In times of war, in times of conflict, you can blow up those windmills, they fall down real quick. You can blow up those pipelines, they go like this, and you're not going to fix them too fast. You can do a lot of things to those solar panels, but you know what you can't hurt? Coal. You can do whatever you want to coal.
What was branded as a rally to support State Attorney General Patrick Morrisey's Senate campaign turned out to be more of a victory lap for the administration's newly announced Affordable Clean Energy Rule. Announced Tuesday, the public has 60 days to comment before the rule goes into effect. The proposal would relax emissions limits on power plants, and it's designed as a replacement for the Obama-era Clean Power Plan. It's being hailed as a win for the coal industry, but at this point, can the coal industry even be saved? James Van Nostrand is a professor and director of the Center for Energy and Sustainable Development at West Virginia University College of Law. James, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, Matt. Good to be with you.
So I broadly outlined the rule, but can you get into a little bit of the specifics here? Does this completely erase the Clean Power Plan, and what do the changes mean?
It erases large portions of it. The Clean Power Plan was intended to produce reductions of greenhouse gas emissions of 32% by 2030, the estimates that the greenhouse gas emissions reductions under this replacement plan is more in the lines of 1 to 1.5% by 2030. So it eliminates a substantial portion of the Clean Power Plan.
Give us a sense of where the coal industry is in West Virginia right now and across the country more broadly.
Well, across the country, we've had a substantial number of coal retirements. Formerly, we had about 530 coal plants. We're down to about 260 within West Virginia. We had 16 power plants operating in 2012. We now have 10, and there'll be 9 after the first of the year. I mean, the president may be correct about coal being indestructible, but unfortunately, fewer and fewer utilities are burning it. It's just not cost effective as compared to natural gas, wind, and solar.
Does the rule help prevent the decline of the industry in any way, the new rule?
There's an aspect of it called the new source review. The slight revisions they're making to that may allow some existing coal plants to run a little bit longer. We don't see any utilities changing their plans based on this rule. No utility is building new coal plants, but it may extend the life of some existing plants by enabling utilities to make some minor improvements without doing wholesale upgrades that would have otherwise been required under the new source review.
Would that mean they'd be hiring? And obviously, a lot of this comes back to jobs. I mean, could there be an increase in coal industry jobs, at least in the short term?
There's really no projections that show that. I mean, there's the metallurgical coal market. Met coal is used to make steel. There's been a decent upturn there in employment. But for the steam or thermal coal, that market's depressed, and you may have existing plants run a little bit longer, but in terms of new plants, anything's going to cause an increase in production. I don't see that happening.
So you live in Western Pennsylvania and you work in West Virginia. Is your sense that miners and others in the industry realize that, as you're saying here, that the rule change is not a long-term solution to the problems involved with the industry?
I think it's unfortunate that the president comes to Charleston and tries to raise expectation and hopes of the miners. In some respects, it's cruel to do so because it's really not going to change the long-term prospects for the coal industry. At the same time, I'm hearing from miners, reading some of the articles in the press, they do like having somebody in the White House who they feel is on their side. So even though they may be fairly realistic about the ability of the coal industry to come back, It's at least reassuring to them that someone's coming out there and saying the right things.
Yeah, it has an emotional effect, if nothing else.
Yes, exactly.
The fine print reveals that there could be 1,400 premature deaths every year because of these changes. Is that a reasonable estimate? And where does that number come from?
Well, there are a lot of judgment calls when EPA does what's called a regulatory impact analysis or a cost-benefit analysis. And basically, if the coal plants continue to operate longer, we have what's called co-benefits, and that's the other pollutants in addition to CO2. And so those estimates are based on the fact that you might still have particulate matter, soot, things that contribute to ozone if these coal plants continue to operate, and that could result in more premature deaths. But there are a lot of judgment calls, really, in terms of how to do that cost-benefit analysis. Another example is they're talking about how this new plan will result in lower electricity rates. Well, if utilities are actually using more natural gas, wind and solar, and coal is more expensive, it would seem like if we're going to have more coal or the coal plants lasting longer, that would result in higher utility rates. And so there are a lot of manipulation of these numbers, frankly, and the Trump administration is coming under fire for its efforts to undo a couple elements of the Obama Climate Action Plan. And a lot of it is messing with these numbers on how they do the cost-benefit analysis.
Who does the cost-benefit analysis? Is that the administration? Is that the DEP?
Yes,
how does that work?
EPA staff.
The EPA,
yeah,
sorry,
EPA
yeah.
staff. Utilities will provide the estimates in terms of what the compliance costs will be, and then the staff will try to come up with numbers in terms of what are the health benefits in terms of reduced premature death, fewer hospital visits, fewer lost time days from work.
How are the other health and environmental changes, how might they be felt if this rule goes into place?
Well, I think it's just going to have, you're going to have increased pollutants in the atmosphere if we have these coal plants running longer. Those are the localized impacts of particulate matter, soot, more ozone. And what that will lead to is premature deaths, more emergency room visits, things like that, more lost time from work.
Today, news of Trump's speech and the rule change, is this on the cover of the newspaper? Is this what people are talking about? over in West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania?
Yes, and all the politicians in West Virginia are very supportive and very enthusiastic about this rule change. It's pretty much uniformity, bipartisan across the board. This is a great thing for West Virginia.
James Van Nostrand is professor of law and director of the Center for Energy and Sustainable Development at West Virginia University College of Law. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is The Takeaway. Matt Katz back with you, filling in for Tanzina Vega this week. On Monday, a district judge ruled that Michigan's Department of Health director will stand trial for the deaths of two men who allegedly died of Legionnaire's disease connected to the Flint water crisis. 12 people died from the waterborne form of pneumonia after Flint switched its drinking water source to the Flint River in 2014. Nick Lyon is the highest-ranking official to be charged in connection to the crisis. Reporter for Michigan Radio Steve Carmody was in Flint for the hearing.
Mr. Lyon's attorneys maintain that he should not be held accountable for all of the 14,000 people who work under him as the head of the largest department in state government. They insist that he did what he was expected to do. He relied on the experts within his department to make the decisions that needed to be made. They say he doesn't bear the responsibility for this because there were other people further down the line who failed to do their jobs.
And those jobs and those decisions related to informing the public about the situation with the water supply or actually keeping the water supply safe?
Well, when we're talking about the involuntary manslaughter charges, this deals with the outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, which took place during the time of the water switch. There is some difference of opinion on experts whether you can directly relate the two, but we know that in January 2015, Nick Lyon and other members of the State Health Department became aware of the Legionnaire's disease outbreak that was taking place in the Flint, Genesee County area. At that time, they decided to treat this as more of an internal matter. They did send out some information to hospitals and doctors in the area to tell them to be on the lookout for this, but they did not make a public announcement about the Legionnaire's disease outbreak until a year later in January 2016. At that point, another six people had died, 40 more people had ended up in the hospital, and that includes the two men for whom he is now facing involuntary manslaughter charges.
And these charges are coming from the Michigan Attorney General's office, but can you explain the peculiar situation involving the Michigan Attorney General at the moment?
Yeah, at this point, up to this point in the investigation and various other legal aspects of this of the crisis, about $23 to $30 million has been spent, both prosecuting people for criminal charges, but also the state is also paying to defend the state officials who have been charged criminally by the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office also is defending the state government in civil litigation. So the Attorney General's office has had to set up basically firewalls within its own department because you have various parts of it that are either prosecuting or defending the state in these very same cases.
And on top of all of that, the Attorney General is running for governor.
Yes. Bill Schuette, who's been the Attorney General throughout this entire crisis, is now trying to get the top job of governor in the state. He recently won the Republican primary. And this crisis and how he has responded to it is a major issue in the campaign.
And what's next in Lyon's criminal case?
Well, at this point, we are beginning the slow process towards an actual trial. His attorneys plan to challenge the judge's decision this week to try to get it tossed, and they're planning to take their case up to the state Supreme Court if they have to. And if does not happen, it's going to still be a long time before we actually end up in a courtroom with Nick Lyon facing a jury.
Steve Carmody is a reporter for Michigan Radio. He joined us from Flint. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
In at least 17 states across the nation, prisoners are refusing to work, holding sit-ins, and going on hunger strikes. On Tuesday night, protesters on the outside brought plastic horns, pots and pans, and other makeshift instruments to take part in a noise demonstration outside the Metropolitan Detention Center, a federal detention facility in Brooklyn where inmates are awaiting trial. The aim was to make enough noise so detainees could hear them through the building's narrow rectangular windows. Kevin Steele was one of the demonstrators. He spent 8 years behind bars for assault from the time he was 17. He got out earlier this year.
The worst feeling inside the prison is probably the water system, how we shower in brown water. They have us drinking brown water, and it's mold in the shower areas. So that's probably the worst thing that they could possibly do to someone that's living in America. At least America's not a third world country.
Steele says that people who have never been to prison probably don't understand exactly what a prison strike looks like.
When you hear prison strike, you think it's just going to be some rioting going on, and that's not the case. The case is that they want human rights. They're fighting for human rights, whether it's peaceful sit-down, sit-ins, or it's boycotts in the commissary and the mess hall. It's not really about violence. There's a lot of peaceful protesting going on that's out there.
Another protester named Shaniqua Pippin says her little brother is still incarcerated in a facility upstate.
I know what they go through in there because of my little brother and because of just me visiting him. Like, they treat you like you've committed like the worst crimes just for wanting to see your loved one. So I think this show of strength is important, and I think this show of strength shows both the people inside, the cops, the state, everyone here repressing and oppressing us, that we are not going to just lay down and allow this to happen. And like, in the face of the prison industrial complex, in the face of white supremacy, in the face of anything, like, we're going to come out, we're going to come together, and we're going to show that we're going to go out with a fight.
Prisoners on strike are demanding things like restoration of voting rights, a prevailing wage for their labor, and their top demand is, quote, immediate improvements to the conditions of prisons and prison policies that recognize the humanity of imprisoned men and women. Nicholas Turner is the president of the Vera Institute of Justice, and I asked him, what is it about American prisons that's so dehumanizing?
The conditions in America's prisons that are dehumanizing and that are the source of protest really run the gamut from what I would describe as everyday corrosive dehumanization in prison. You aren't called by a name. You're called by a number. You don't eat a meal. You are given a meal at feeding time. You have no decision-making capacity. There are barriers to forming relationships. There's sort of an unending sense of idleness. So all of those things that are really quotidian and seem mundane are things that really end up dehumanizing. So it goes from that all the way through to really massively punitive and overused disciplinary structures like solitary confinement. And then I would say, you know, everything in between.
There are prisons run by private companies. There's prisons run by the state, some run by the federal government. And then you have thousands of local jails all over the country. Is there any way to look at this whole prison system and look at the conditions to determine whether or not they're getting better or worse?
Matt, that's a great question. This is the remarkable state of affairs, which is that we have 2.2 million people who are incarcerated in private and public prisons and jails, as you mentioned, and detention centers. And there is very little transparency. And that sort of unseeable, inaccessible condition means that it's a massively neglected area of reform interest, because people can go about their daily lives while we have 2.2 million people locked up and they see no evidence of that experience. And if you contrast that with say, the videos of police shootings of black people that we've seen over the course of the past few years, what those videos did for the American public is they shook people out of their complacency. People finally were able to see things that were happening and challenge their faulty assumptions about how the justice system was operating in that circumstance, policing. There is nothing like this in the prison context. So people have no accessibility, and as a result, we're malignly neglectful of it.
How do all these conditions in this system compare to that in other developed nations across the world? What are prisons like elsewhere?
So the conditions of prisons elsewhere vary dramatically, but in Germany, for example, the underlying principle in prisons is a commitment to human dignity. And we can take a lesson from that, because Germany, after World War II, committed government to the protection and restoration of human dignity as a result of its terrible history of the Holocaust. And so Germany said, we need to acknowledge that terrible history. We're never going to go back. And as a result, government must protect human dignity. And you see this in prisons. People have privacy. They control the locks to their cell doors. They can wear their own clothes. They are called by their own names. In many of the prisons, they can leave for the day and go to work and return at night. And I think America can learn a lot from this, because we have our own history of slavery and racial oppression and white supremacy. But yet, as a country, we have really failed to adequately come to terms with it and atone. And instead, what we have is a system that continues to dehumanize, albeit in different ways than it might have been the case in 1850, but it's still iteration of the same sort of societal instinct. So I think we need to look to places like Germany that have committed to human dignity and have done so not just because they think it's a more constructive way to run a justice system, but because it's an act of reconciliation.
Before we leave you, can you take a moment to tell Americans who have no connection to our criminal justice system, maybe they don't know anybody who's locked up, why you think they should care about the conditions of incarcerated folks?
What would you want for your kid? What would you want for your brother? What would you want for your father if he ran afoul of the law and was incarcerated? We do way too much us versus them in this country. We tend to sort of otherize people who are deemed criminal. And and you see it in political dialogue right now. And what we really should be doing is remembering that everyone who is incarcerated is someone's child. And then the last thing that I would say is pragmatism. More than 90% of people who are in prison are going to come out. They're going to be released, and they're going to come back and live with us. And do we want them to be damaged, or do we want them to be given the help that they need to be able to succeed upon release?
Thanks for joining me, Nicholas, and sharing your perspective on imprisonment in America.
Matt, thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Nicholas Turner is the president of the Vera Institute of Justice. Thanks to Takeaway producer Gwen Hogan for her reporting from the protest on Tuesday in Brooklyn. And that's our show today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tenzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.